Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's joint program of the Commonwealth Club and the Marines Memorial Association. I'm Major General Myatt, President and CEO of the Marines Memorial Association. For information on the Commonwealth Club, please visit their website, commonwealthclub.org. And on the Marines Memorial, visit their website, marineclub.com. It's now my pleasure to introduce the distinguished speaker, Mark Bowden. I know he used to work for the Philadelphia Inquirer when the editor was Robert Rosenthal. He was a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, national correspondent for Atlantic, and noted author of Black Hawk Down, and his newest book, Hue 1968, A Turning Point on the American War in Vietnam. He's a noted author, journalist, and screenwriter, and a teacher. His book, Black Hawk Down, was the international bestseller that spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list. He is currently an adjunct professor at Loyola College of Maryland, his alma mater. Mr. Bowden hasn't written a book about the military since Black Hawk Down. He's here to discuss his most ambitious work yet, Hue 68, the story of the centerpiece Tet Offensive and a turning point in the Vietnam War. And if you're watching the Ken Burns series last night, they had their session on the Tet Offensive. So this is timely. By January 1968, despite an influx of 500,000 American troops, the fighting in Vietnam seemed to be at a stalemate. Yet General William Westmoreland, commander of American forces, announced a new phase of the war when he stated, "The end begins to come into view." The North Vietnamese had different ideas. The leadership in Hanoi had started planning an offensive intended to win the war in a single stroke, part military action and a planned popular uprising. The Tet Offensive included attacks across South Vietnam, but the most dramatic would be the capture of Hue, the country's cultural capital. At 2:30 in the morning on January 31st, 10,000 National Liberation Front troops descended from hidden camps and surged across the city of 140,000. By morning, all of Hue was in enemy hands, save for two small military outposts. The commanders in country and the politicians in Washington refused to believe in size and scope of the enemy's presence. Marine commanders would come up with a strategy to retake the city, block by block and building by building, in some of the most intense combat, urban combat, since World War II. Played out over 24 days of terrible fighting and ultimately costing 10,000 combatants and civilian lives, the Battle of Hue was by far the bloodiest of the entire Vietnam War. Although the battle was a tactical defeat for the North Vietnamese, it was a strategic defeat for America, because when it ended, The American debate was never again about winning, only about how to leave. Today's program will focus on this pivotal moment and how it changed the American debate after the war. Mr. Bowden will speak for a few minutes, followed by a conversational question period moderated by Major General Ray Smith. Ray Smith, he's a friend of mine. He served in the Marine Corps actively from 1965 until 1999. His personal decorations, here, listen to this. He has a Navy Cross, the Distinguished Service Medal, 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legion of Merit Awards, the Bronze Star, and 3 Purple Hearts. He was in the Battle of Hawaii as the company commander of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines. General Smith and Mr. Bowden will also be joined by Richard Horner, who served as a platoon commander during the Battle of Hawaii, and he has an interesting story to tell, too. Please help me welcome Mr. Mark Bowden.
Well, thank you very much, General Myatt, and my thanks to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me back. They've put me up in a lovely suite here at the Marine Memorial, and the walls are lined with framed photographs of the celebrities who've appeared at these events, and I was making my way down the wall of pictures, and I found my own. So I was sort of felt right at home. Reminded me I'd been here before. It's also very fitting, you know, that we're talking about this here in the Marine Memorial, because this is a story not all about Marines, but largely about Marines. And I have a connection to the Marine Corps, several actually. My son, William, joined the Marines in 1998. And when he left to go to Parris Island for boot camp, he took an early draft in manuscript of my book, Black Hawk Down, which had not yet been published. I, you know, tells you how much the kid knew about the Marine Corps. He thought he'd have reading time at Parris Island. So the manuscript was confiscated the minute he stepped off the bus. But when I went down for his graduation, the officers at Parris Island invited me out for drinks and gave me the manuscript back. It was blackened with thumbprints. They'd been passing it around and reading it with great enthusiasm. It was really one of the first indications I had that that book was going to get some traction. I also have had the honor, I served on the Civilian Advisory Board for the Marine Corps Museum's most recent expansion, and was the most unlikely person to be in the room with a bunch of retired generals talking about how to present Marine Corps history. I think that the Battle of Hawaii is one that has never really made it into our popular memory of the Vietnam War, and there are a lot of reasons for that. It's never been forgotten by the Marine Corps, I think that the general public and even most histories of the war in Vietnam have failed to give this incident the importance that it deserves. It has a tremendous significance, I think, for the Vietnam War, but also in American history and certainly in the annals of our military. It was one of the bloodiest and most difficult engagements in American military history. As General Myatt said, you know, on the morning of January 31st, 1968, 10,000 enemy troops achieved complete surprise and took all of the city except for 2 small, encircled, and embattled outposts, one in Southern Hue, an American compound, and the other inside the Citadel, which forms the northern part of the city. And it took a month of bitter fighting, house to house and door to door, to take the city back. The book, Hue 1968, tries to tell the story from the streets of Hue to the Oval Office. And it's a great story. You can say that when you write true stories because you don't make them up. So quite apart from my delivery of the story, I have to say this is one of the most powerful stories that I've had the opportunity to write. I think that one way to better understand the war in Vietnam is to dig very deeply into one event like this. And I think you see in the story of the Battle of Hue a lot of the issues both within the military and in American society and in Vietnam that played important roles in the larger story. And it was also my goal when I set out to be the first to tell the story of a major confrontation in Vietnam through the eyes of both Americans and Vietnamese. And it was a challenge, but was for me one of the most fascinating and interesting parts of the project. My goal whenever I write a story or a book is to arrive at my own understanding of what happened. I'm professionally curious about how and why things happen in the world. This effort took 6 years. I interviewed hundreds of American veterans and scores of Vietnamese veterans and civilians over two separate trips to Vietnam. I plundered the National Archives in Bethesda, Maryland for what I could find there, and I also worked at the LBJ Library in Austin, Texas, at the University of Texas, where all of General Westmoreland's papers are and where the minutes and papers from President Johnson's National Security Council. I also used and had the advantage of using the audio recordings from President Johnson's Oval Office, where he would call and have very candid discussions. Some of these, if you've been watching the Ken Burns series, you've been hearing some of these conversations, which really are amazing in putting you back in the moment and really understanding what the president was thinking and why he was making the decisions he made. I was able to make use of the archives of the war in Hanoi to better understand the North Vietnamese side of the story, and took advantage of the oral history project at the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico, Virginia, where a number of the participants, notably Lieutenant Colonel Ernie Cheatham, who passed away before I had an opportunity to interview him, gave long interviews for that oral history project about his experiences in Hue, which were invaluable to me. So it was a lot of fun, and I had a ball doing it. And my work is not a grind. I get to meet fascinating characters like General Smith or Rich Horner, who were in the middle of this battle. A character who is from my hometown up in Philadelphia, a guy named Richard Loeffler, who found himself thrust into the middle of this terrible battle at age 18, having forged the papers to enlist in the Marine Corps at age 17, thinking he was a really tough guy. He got in lieu of going to juvenile hall because a local magistrate told him, I got to put you somewhere, so you either have to go to juvie or you're going in the Marine Corps. And Lefty thought he was a tough guy until he landed in the middle of the Battle of Hue. And if you read the story, he finds himself within minutes of being thrown into this battle, trapped in a bunker underground with decaying dead bodies, horrified, but too terrified to get out because there's this terrible battle raging overhead. And I contrast, you know, the story of Lefty, who knew nothing about Vietnam, who couldn't have found it on a map, who couldn't have explained what communism was, except that it was something bad and that something he was obliged to fight, with the story of another 18-year-old, Che Thi Mung, who was a village girl from the outskirts of Hue, whose family had been fighting for two generations. Her grandfather and her father had fought with the Viet Minh. Her older sister had joined the Viet Cong to fight against the Americans and had been killed. When her older sister had been killed, Che, at age 16, was arrested and interrogated about her family and about her friends in her village. And when I met her in Hue, she's a couple years older than me. She's an ophthalmologist now. She's extremely proud of not having given up any information during that interrogation session all these years later. Just the cast of characters is incredible and amazing. I ate great food when I was in Vietnam. My guide for my second trip was a fellow named Dinh Linh, who is Anthony Bourdain's guide when he does his shows from Vietnam. And we would go to restaurants and people would be asking Lien to pose for selfies with them. So he was, turns out, a celebrity too. I think that as, you know, all these interviews come together, your understanding of the battle grows, kind of story by story. And at a certain point in the research and reporting, you have to force yourself to stop. This was a battle that involved tens of thousands of participants, Americans, combatants from the Vietnamese side, and civilians. And so I began to kind of pull back from it when I came back after my second trip to Vietnam and tried to figure out how to write this. I am not an expert on the war in Vietnam. I am, I would have to say, something of an expert now on this battle. I think after 6 years of research and reporting, I can probably lay claim to knowing more about it than just about anybody. And so I can, I think, count myself that. You know, I think that the whole war, viewed from an American perspective, is one that was fought over really more than a decade and that involved five different American presidencies. But for the Vietnamese, the war was bigger than that. It was a generations-long struggle against the French and against the Japanese and against the Americans and then against the Chinese, and then they fought against the Cambodians. So a lot of these vets in Vietnam who I would interview were just astonished that I was focusing so narrowly on this one battle in this one phase of the war, when to them they had a much, much bigger story to tell. But that was not my goal. One of the questions that I'm always asked about the Battle of Hue, anytime you write the story of a battle, people want to know who won. And I think that's a good question without a good answer. Without question, American forces and South Vietnamese forces successfully recaptured the city of Hue at great cost. And so in that sense, it was without question a victory. But so much was lost in that process that it ended up being a defeat for just about everyone involved. And only in the long term did it actually emerge to be a very positive thing for the enemy, for the communist government in Hanoi, because of the impact that it had on the American public's perception of the war. I think that the real losers in Hue were the civilians in the city. There, I think more civilians were killed in this battle by far than any of the combatants. And one of the things, frankly, that shocked me in researching the story of this battle was how little concern was expressed at any level for the plight of the civilians who were trapped in that city. In Northern Hue in particular, they were literally trapped. It's a fortress with only 9 gates in and out. And the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army were not thrilled with the idea of the civilians running away, because they expected them to rise up in support of the revolution and help them fight. So the civilians were being trapped by the NVA and the Viet Cong. And then when American forces arrived and the battle began to rage inside the citadel, there was no safe place to be. At that point, Americans were bombing, using napalm, using heavy artillery. And what many of the people in the city had done was dig bunkers and crawl into them under their houses. And when I was back in Hue, people would say to me that there's a dead person for every square of concrete in the city, for every square meter in the city. The estimates, are in many thousands of people perished who basically just couldn't get out of the way. So in the end, the United States and the South Vietnamese retook the city. They destroyed 80% of it. 80% of the citizens of Hue were homeless at the end of the battle. So I think it's pretty hard to call that a victory. There were two examples of leadership in the book that really stuck in my mind. One was General William Westmoreland, who was so convinced that he understood what was going on in South Vietnam. He understood the battlefield so well that he didn't believe that the attacks that came during Tet could happen. And his conviction was so strong that even after it did happen, he refused to believe that it did. And as a consequence of that refusal, he was still saying days after the city of Hue was taken that there were no more than 500 or so enemy troops in the city. He was off by a factor of 20. And as a result of that conviction, young Americans, Marines for the most part, but also soldiers, were being sent out to attack positions that were overwhelmingly one-sided. They were literally as many as 100, 200 Marines sent to attack positions that were held by thousands of enemy forces. And there were a lot of Americans who died because of that refusal to believe what the young battlefield commanders were relaying to the headquarters at Phu Bai and back to Saigon. So that was a general who was so convinced of the rightness of his theory that nothing could penetrate it, nothing could change it. The other alternative, an alternative to that leadership, is Lieutenant Colonel Ernie Cheatham, who I mentioned earlier, who sadly I never had an opportunity to interview. But Ernie Cheatham was a former NFL football player. He played for the Baltimore Colts and the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was traded from the Steelers to the Colts, as he put it, for a helmet and a water bucket. And Ernie, when he realized his paycheck stopped coming from the NFL when the season ended, went back in the Marine Corps. He had lost several of his companies that had been sent up into Hue, taken from him, and so he arrived at Phu Bai the day after the city was taken, demanding that he be sent to Hue to pull his battalion back together and to coordinate their fighting. And so he was sent to Hue, and Ernie Cheatham, in contrast to General Westmoreland, left with the assumption that he did not know what he was facing. He didn't know what was going on. He didn't know how many enemy were in the city. He didn't know where they were. He didn't know what kind of weapons they had. All he knew was that he was going to be fighting in a city. And he knew he had never done that. And his men had never done that. So he spent the whole night before he left for Hue searching out Marine Corps manuals about how to fight in an urban environment, how to attack a well-fortified position, and rounded up the kinds of weapons he felt would be most useful when he got to Hue. And when he arrived on the 4th of February, 3 days after the city fell, he began coordinating the counterattack, which eventually took the city back and gave some coherence to the American response. Two very different kinds of leadership. Personally, if I was going to war, I'd want to go with the guy who says he doesn't know what's going on and is doing his very best to figure it out. But I do hope that you get a chance to read the book, and I'm looking forward to my conversation with General Smith and with Rich, who can tell you from their own perspective what it was like to be in Hue on those days. Thank you.
It is our goal here to ask the questions that came from the audience. If it seems to be slacking or lacking, then I'll ask a question or two of my own. But for the most part, we're going to ask questions that came from the audience. And the first one, since you ended with the this. I got a question for the audience that I thought would be very interesting concerning General LeHue. General LeHue, for those of you who didn't hear it, was the Task Force X-Ray Commander that all of us who were in way was responding to. He was our overall commander. And the question was, and I know since the book came well after the fact that you were unable to interview many of these more senior people
right.
that had to make these decisions, but did anybody give you any indication of why General LeHue never went up the road and found out what was going on?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it would have been a good idea for him to do it. In his defense, you know, there were attacks all through the region on January 31st, including attacks on Fubai, and I think there was a period where there was very little awareness of exactly where the fight was, you know, where to deploy forces, and so I think he probably... You could make an argument that it was a good idea for him to stay put until he had things better figured out. But at the point where he realized that the big fight was going to take place in Hue, I would have thought he would have wanted to be there.
Do you? Can you answer for somebody? I don't know the answer to this, but perhaps you do. Do you know what happened to Lefty?
Yes, Lefty survived the battle and served out the remainder of his tour in Vietnam, came home a very disturbed young man. He had a severed ear of a Viet Cong soldier he had killed that he hung in a necklace around his neck. And as he described it to me, he would go out every night and get drunk and pick fights with people. He's a little guy. I think he had a lot to try to prove, and he was a tough Marine who survived Vietnam. He drank very heavily, struggled throughout his life to sort of deal with the experiences that he had in Vietnam. When I met him, you know, he had undergone a lot of counseling. He'd written some stories about his experiences in Vietnam, found it very difficult to talk about his experiences. But I loved his story for the candor, because he talked freely about how terrified he was and what a comeuppance it was for him to realize that he wasn't really such a tough guy after all.
And here's an opportunity for you to reflect on how to tell the whole story, perhaps, but someone in this audience wants to know, and they've caused me to want to know, why did you include the story about Marines paying for sex with sea rations? Why was that even included?
Because, you know, my goal when I write a story is to describe what actually happened. I think that I can understand that someone else might write a story about an American military engagement overseas that has as a primary goal to capture and embellish the heroism of America's fighting man. I think, frankly, the heroism of the men that I'm writing about in this book is plain and comes through very clearly. But I also believe it's my responsibility to tell some of the terrible things that happened as well. And frankly, I think that the validity of the stories that I tell about the good and heroic actions of individuals gains credibility when it's part of an account that clearly is not weighted one way or the other. So I thought it was important. It's a poignant story. It's told by a young man who had written an editorial in his high school newspaper about the importance of the United States fighting to defend the democracy for the South Vietnamese people, volunteered for the Marines, went to Vietnam, fought, was decorated in this battle, but in the course of it found himself with a group of other Marines lined up to have sex with a woman who had agreed to have sex with him in return for their sea ration portions. And he realized even then that this woman was not a prostitute. She was hungry, and she was trying to feed her family. And he talked with great passion about how deeply ashamed he remains of himself for having taken part in that. So to me, that told an important story, and that's why it's in the book.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And here's one that's very current. I know no historian likes to question another historian, but in your view, is Ken Burns' presentation of at least this portion of the Vietnam War, is it accurate?
I think so. I think it is extraordinary. And I think the filmmakers there have gone further than anyone ever has to solicit the points of view of everyone involved, which is exactly the way that I like to approach the writing that I do. I think it's compelling television. It's powerful. The overlapping voices, I particularly like the fact that the story is being told from the ground up, from the people, both Vietnamese and Americans, who were caught up in the war. I think that the side stories about some of the individual American soldiers and how and why they fought there and what happened to them and how they feel about it now today is one of the most important and interesting aspects of the story. So I haven't seen the whole series, but I've read the companion volume, and I would recommend it as probably the best single volume history of the war in Vietnam, and it also has lots of amazing pictures.
I was separated from Alpha Company, my company, by events that I won't relate right now, but did not go in with them on the first day. And Captain Batchelor, who was the commanding officer of the company, was shot badly very early on. So the company was actually two platoons, and the company was led by the company gunnery sergeant. And the two platoon commanders were both Sergeant E5s, because my platoon sergeant, staff sergeant, was shot at the same time the captain was. But the intel brief that I received, even though I didn't go up until 2 days later, the intel brief that I received was that there was at least a reinforced platoon of NVA in the city.
And tell them about how many men that would be.
Well, I've said many times over the years that was a true statement. There was, in fact, at least a reinforced platoon of NVA in the city. Unfortunately, they had been reinforced. That platoon had been reinforced with a full division. So I want to turn to Rich, because you came in the same day I did, I believe.
No, I came in on the 1st.
The 1st of February.
1st of February.
Yeah. So what did you think you knew about what was in front of you when you went up there?
I was part of Lieutenant Colonel Cheatham's Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines. And we had been deployed in the field south of Fubai when the Tet started, and we were pulled out and sent back to Fubai. And we got helicoptered into Way City on Thursday afternoon, the 1st of February, and we were told that, all of us, that there was not an issue there, there was not a problem, we would be back by dinner time. And when we, in Mark's book, he mentions the fact that an Air Force guy talked to one of my platoon squad leaders and told him that the orders we had gotten to go down this one particular street, one block, to secure the communication center, that somebody at Golf Company had gone down there earlier in the day and had gotten into some serious problems. So my squad leader came back to me and said, do you really think we ought to go down there? Well, if you've been in the Marine Corps and you're told to go down there, and your squad leader says, should you go down there, you go down there. So there were a few fortunate things that had happened on the first day that Alpha Company went in there. One was that they had hooked up with four Patton tanks and some dusters and other support vehicles had gotten into the MACV compound. So they were there. They were assets that were not made available to us, so we didn't even know that they existed. So we were told to go down and secure this communication center, and my platoon was selected to lead the way down this street. So we went off and went down the street, and the two squads were on each side of the street, and then I had one squad a street over, and then the third platoon was over a street on the right. They let us get all the way halfway down to the next intersection and opened up on us. And we had several Marines go down immediately. It was chaos. It was there was no way for us to maneuver down the street. There was no way that we now could get out of this situation. We were down the street so far that with no cover that we were not going to get out of there alive. And I remember going back a couple times and talking to Captain Downs, who was my company commander, telling him we could not get down that street to the communication center. And his instructions were, keep pressing ahead. Well, the further we tried to press down the street, the further we were in a situation where it was going to be more difficult to get out. Just about a time when things were, we had tried every option that we thought was available to try to maneuver to get a position where we could get our wounded and dead off the street and get back. There were two platoons or two Patton tanks that came rolling down the street that were from the MACV compound. And no one instructed me as to what they were doing, but they were assets we could use. So by that time, we had decided that we weren't going to go down that street any further, that all we needed to do was to get as many of our people off that street as we could. The two tankers that came down there, there was no communications through the phone on the back of the tank, so we had to find radio frequencies and get hooked up with them. Myself and my platoon radio operator, we finally managed to get contact with them. And about that time, my platoon radio operator got shot and killed. And after retrieving the radio and managing to get started again, we started moving the two tanks down the street. Well, as soon as we got the tanks out there, we started getting B-40 rockets bouncing off the tanks. We started getting a tremendous amount of fire, but we managed to move far enough down that we got to our furthest point man and managed to collect all of our wounded and KIAs behind the tanks and back out of the street. That was my introduction to sniper fire and getting back to Fubai for dinner.
But Rich, tell them what happened to you in the course of this.
Well, unfortunately, one of the B-40 rockets hit close to me, and I picked up shrapnel from that. I didn't go down. I was hit, but I managed to stay cognizant of what was going on until we had gotten everyone off the street, and on the way back to MACV compound, I passed out, and they carried me back there, and I spent the night on a table wondering whether or not we were going to make it through the night. I think one of the things that isn't clear or it doesn't come across very strongly is the MACV compound could have been overrun any time they wanted to. I mean, it was a hotel. And basically very modest defenses. There were maybe 200 people there, not a trained security force, but a bunch of people that were there, and that never happened. So the next morning they got me out on a medevac, and next thing I know I was in Yokohama.
And Rich's story actually illustrates one of the difficulties that I faced in telling the story of the battle. Everyone that I interviewed had a story to tell up until a point. In Rich's case, it was a day, or part of a day, and then he was gone from the battle. So many of the men who fought in Hue were carried out of the city that it was very rare to find someone whose experience took them all the way through.
In that first three-day period, like I said, only two of the three platoons of Alpha Company went in on the first day, and then I joined them on the 3rd of February with the other platoon and some first reinforcements. But in that three-day period, 146 Marines from Alpha Company went into the city, and when we came out of the city, it was 34 days later before we went back to Fubai, seven of the 146 were still in the company. They weren't all killed by any means.
General Smith, tell the story of how there was a fellow named Alfredo Gonzalez,
yes,
who was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his heroism in the battle, and he had distinguished himself in the first day of fighting into the city. And you,
oh, you want to tell him about how I was going
to
lead?
I want you to tell how you had decided you wanted Gunny Canley to take over a platoon, and what he told you.
I got up there. The company commander had been wounded. My platoon sergeant, was staff sergeant named Godfrey, was wounded at the same time Batchelor was. So Gunny Canley, I had a guide in my platoon who was a Sergeant E5 that was an aviation, for you Marines in the room, was an aviation supply NCO. Had finished a tour with the wing in Da Nang, full year, and had reenlisted in country for a lateral move to the 03 field, to the infantry field. So his heart was all in the right place, but he knew nothing about what we were doing. And he ended up taking command of the platoon that day. So when I got up there on the 3rd to relieve the gunny as the company commander, Lieutenant Rick Donnelly, who had 1st Platoon, was with me. We had a lieutenant artillery FO in the company also, but he was with me up in Fubai, or in Quang Tri, when this all started. So he went in on the trucks with me. We went in with hotel company on the 3rd, or maybe it was the 2nd. I may have the day wrong. But and Lieutenant Perkins was killed on the way in, you know, on the trucks. So I get up there. And I had a new staff sergeant that they had assigned to the company. So I told Gunny Canley that I was going to assign this Staff Sergeant Parker, this new Staff Sergeant, to 2nd Platoon as the platoon commander. Canley knew him, and he said, good, that's good. And I said, Gunny, I want you to take over 3rd Platoon. Canley said, Gonzalez got 3rd Platoon. I said, well, I know Gunny, but, you know, he's young, and I'd just feel better if you take 3rd Platoon. Canley very rarely ever spoke more than a few words at a time. He was like Tonto used to be in the Lone Ranger, like we go now. He used the subject and the verb, very few adjectives. He said, louder to make sure I was listening, Gonzalez got 3rd Platoon. I said, I'd feel better, Gunny, if you'd take 3rd Platoon. He said, Lieutenant, Gonzalez got 3rd Platoon. And if I survive this fight, I'm going to see to it he gets the big one for what he's already done. Now, if you want me to go down there and follow behind 3rd Platoon, if that's really what you want me to do, I'll do it. But Gonzalez got 3rd Platoon. So it sunk into my thick skull about that time that the gunny thought maybe probably be better if he followed me around for everybody's sake. And he was absolutely correct. And Gonzalez it ended up posthumously because he was killed the very next day after we had this discussion. But Gonzalez was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. And the Navy, God bless him, has named a destroyer after him. And his mother and I are still in contact very, very regularly. He's a great guy. Okay, here's a question for you.
I'm ready.
I actually have two or three versions of this question. I'm going to try to kind of combine them into one.
All right.
One version, well, I'll just combine. You appear to give short shrift to the thousands of civilians that were killed by the NLF. Mm-hmm. And secondly, related to that, but not exactly, Burns' documentary says 2,800 women and children were executed by the NLF during their retreat from Hue.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was in some ways a preface to the Khmer Rouge that came later?
Well, it certainly
kind of
shows
a two-part question.
Yeah, it certainly shows what zealots will do when they're given complete power. And I didn't short shrift the executions or what I call the purges in Hue. I did maybe in my remarks up here, but I certainly didn't in the book. In fact, you know, what happened was after the NVA and the Viet Cong took the city of Hue, they had about a three-week period where they set up their own revolutionary government. And one of their goals, which I explain in detail in the book, was to track down people who worked for the Saigon government, people who supported the Saigon government, people who were perceived as being supportive of the Saigon government, and to round them up and assign punishments. In some cases, the punishments were execution on the spot. In other cases, they were marched off supposedly to re-education camps and never came back. The estimates of those who were killed range from 300, which is Hanoi's official count, to 2,800, which was the account made by Douglas Pike, who was an American USIA officer who made a study of it in Hue immediately after it happened. In my book, one of the things that I was most pleased about was that I found two young Vietnamese, they were then young soldiers, who were essentially appointed commissars, political commissars, with the responsibility for making these life and death decisions about the people who were arrested and rounded up. And one of them, Nguyen Doc Xuan, confessed to me his involvement in the execution of people and that there were many innocent people who were killed and is ashamed of his involvement and feels that the government of Hanoi has never acknowledged the fact that these executions took place, and that he feels very strongly that the government of Hanoi should. So it's obviously a difficult issue to document 50 years after the fact, but nearly every NVA and Viet Cong participant who I interviewed was asked about the executions and purges, and all of them acknowledged that this had taken place. They call it mistakes. There were mistakes that were made. But let me just add, there was no shortage of ways to die in Hue. If you weren't being rounded up and executed by the communists, you were ducking artillery and napalm from jets overhead. And as I said, there was almost no way out of the city. Most of the civilians who survived, who I interviewed, when I asked them what they feared the most in the battle, they said the artillery and the bombs. That was the most frightening aspect of the whole battle.
Yeah, I think that goes back also to something we didn't mention earlier. In the first days of the Tet Offensive in Hue, not only were we given the wrong information about the size of the enemy forces, we were absolutely forbidden to use any weapons other than rifles and machine guns. We had tanks up there, we couldn't use them. They were there, but they couldn't fire their guns. There was no artillery, there was no support whatsoever, because they were concerned about damage to the city. So when the first couple, 3 days when we were having all these problems, there was no support that we could call in to, which was a typical way that we would handle a situation like that.
Right.
So just further complicated.
And that was definitely true in the early stages of the fighting, but when it became apparent the size and significance of the enemy force, those rules were lifted.
Finally lifted, yes, but it was after a lot of people were...
A lot of people were killed before that.
And even as late as when the young Marines of 1-5 crossed the green line, as they said, they were not allowed to use supporting arms, even though the ban on supporting arms had been lifted days before
that. It's interesting, if you look back at the rationale, it was, as Rich said, to protect historic buildings in Hue. Nowhere did I see mention of trying to avoid killing the civilians who were trapped in the city in the middle of the fighting.
Yeah, I would reinforce that. I don't remember anybody ever mentioning anything other than protect the cultural treasures that were away, and we didn't protect them in the long run either. What was the attitude of the Hanoi government to your during the project, and related, could be answered in the same voice, or how did you find the members of the Vietnamese military that you interviewed generally?
Well, you know, originally when my first trip to Hanoi, or rather to Hue, and I was in Hanoi first and then Hue, I don't really think the government in Hanoi was very aware of what I was doing. I had to get the necessary approvals to work as a foreign reporter in country, but there are large numbers of foreign reporters, American reporters now, who travel frequently to Vietnam, and it didn't raise any flags with them. So I hired my own translator and fixer, Ho Dang Hoa, and Hoa is fantastic. He's actually he consulted with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on the documentary. So he had a lot of experience. He's a former military officer himself, so he really had a good rapport with the veterans, and he knew his way around the bureaucracy in Hanoi, and it was amazing. And he had a way of really coaching people to feel comfortable and tell their stories. And so sometime between the first trip I made and the second, a year later, somebody in the information ministry must have Googled my name. And so I could no longer work with Hoa. I had the privilege of having the deputy minister of information as my personal fixer and translator. So that had a clear chilling effect. I was telling the story before we came out of how on the first day I went back, we were traveling up to Haiphong to interview this little couple, a veteran of the North Vietnamese Army, and we had to stop every few miles to pick up the local party chief and the local party information chief and then the province chief and the province information chief. So by the time we got to the village, we had a caravan of officialdom behind us, and this poor little guy is sitting in his village house surrounded by every major official, you know, and you can imagine how candid he was talking to me about his experience during the war. Well, I did manage to convince Lynn that I was going home immediately if that didn't stop. And I have to say that he did his best to help me. But I do think, and I say this, and I wrote this in the epilogue of the book, that it's very clear that his presence, I think, was a chilling effect on the stories that people told me. Their memories of the fighting in Hue were every bit as good as the Americans I interviewed. There are some people who, like Rich here and like General Smith, who have very vivid memories of those days and tell great stories. And there are others whose memories have grown kind of foggy. But, you know, I was lucky. Some of the Vietnamese who I interviewed were amazingly willing to speak candidly, including talking about their involvement in the executions and the purges. And I thought that was remarkable. Often I had no idea what they were telling me because I don't speak Vietnamese, and I had to wait until I got home and got my translator to translate the interview to find out what they had actually told me. And I was, to be honest, frankly, fairly pleasantly surprised by the level of detail and then the frankness.
This question is actually a little bit off the subject, but it's very current, and it's a question for you as a historian. Mm-hmm. We are seemingly witnessing an eradication of history with the current trend to remove Confederate and other historical personages throughout our country. What do you think of this trend?
Well, I understand why it's happening. I don't think that it's an effort to erase history. I think what it is an effort to deny public honor to the leaders of the Confederacy. I think many African Americans rightly feel that the Confederacy and the slaveocracy of the 19th century is a black mark on our history as a country. And so I think that it makes sense to me. Building a monument to someone in a public space is a political act. What we're doing as a society is honoring this individual's memory and what they stood for. And I frankly agree that honor does not belong on the leaders of the Confederacy or the Confederate Army. I think those monuments ought to be preserved. They ought to be kept in museums. The history of the Civil War, the history of the Confederacy is a really important part of our country, but I'm not enthusiastic. I'm from the North. My ancestors fought on the Union side. We won that damn war, and I think that flag is an insult to the United States of America.
This question will be unfair unless you've read it, but can you comment at all on the book written by the Vietnamese woman, The Mourning Band?
Yeah.
Mourning Band for Way.
Mourning Band
for Way. It was written like a year after the event.
You know, I thought it was amazingly valuable, and I quote it periodically through my book as an account of what that experience was like for civilians. And it gave a very personal story by a wonderful writer of what her family went through during those days. I think she's made a very valuable contribution to our understanding of the war and what that experience was like, and I was grateful to have that as source material.
These last two or three questions may have come from the epilogue. Which I have personally have some issues with, so I'll be happy to ask these questions. Was there any hope that we could win the war when we decided as early as 1968 to quit and withdraw?
I don't think there was. I think that if the goal, as I understand it, was to protect and to preserve a democratic government in South Vietnam, the absolute primary requirement to achieve that goal would have been to have a democratic government in South Vietnam. The governments of President Diem and President Thieu were not democratic. They were not popular. I think without a partner to support, we had no hope of winning that war. I think President Eisenhower back in 1954, after the Geneva Accords were signed, agreeing to put the leadership of Vietnam up to a popular election within 2 years, he said then that if that popular election is held, that Ho Chi Minh would win that vote by 80%. The fact that the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong were able to assemble a 10,000-man army outside of Hue in the months before the Tet Offensive, without it tripping any alarms to the United States or the South Vietnamese, tells you something about the level of popular support in the surrounding areas around Hue. So short of, I think we would still be there, frankly, if we had found someone we could prop up in Saigon and support him, and we'd probably still be fighting against the Vietnamese who wanted an independent country.
This is not a question, it's a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with you except for the fact that I drove alone in a Jeep with one Vietnamese Marine all around that area, out into those mountains where they assembled, and all over places in Quang Tri province without any fear in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
It's my belief that they completely sacrificed the southern insurgency to the Tet Offensive of 1968, and there was nothing left.
Mm.
But they lost a conventional war.
Mm.
I don't know if you did any research on this, and if you didn't, it's okay.
No, but, no, I
this,
I
is a specific question.
Without question, the communist forces who took a terrible beating, and their forces throughout South Vietnam took a terrible beating after Tet. I think it would have taken them a long time to recover their military capabilities, but given what I understand about the nature of that system and their determination, I think they would have rebuilt it. And I think the chances of our having a freely elected democratic government in Saigon under the succession of generals who took over after Diem was assassinated diminished as time went by. I don't think that they were popular figures, and I don't think they had any real intentions of running or creating a democratic society. I don't think you can create a democratic society.
Well, we will agree to disagree on that. It is to democracy's credit and benefit that casualties dampen enthusiasm for all but the most vitally important conflicts. That's a quote from the book.
Mm-hmm.
Given the casualties during our current conflict, Afghanistan, Iraq, ISIS, etc., have been so low, comparably speaking, is there anything, in your opinion, that can dampen our country's enthusiasm for our current wars?
I think they're pretty dampened already. And I do think it's the nature of warfare in a democracy that the cost of war, and the most important element of cost is obviously the lives of young Americans who go and fight, weighs very heavily. And I don't think it's possible to maintain the kind of war that we fought in Vietnam or we fought in Iraq or Afghanistan, where the goals are at best abstract. You're not talking about defending our borders against an invasion. You're talking about a theory for why we should be fighting in that part of the world. And those theories might be completely valid, but to sustain public support for that kind of a war is a very, very difficult thing over the long haul. And I think that we've seen that play out in just about every war the United States has been involved in since World War II.
I had one more comment I wanted to make before we're finished here regarding casualties. Both General Smith and I were part of two classes of young lieutenants that graduated in 1967, one in November and one earlier in summer. Those two classes made up majority of the platoon commanders in the units in Vietnam and in Hue. Both of those classes just had their 50th anniversary of their graduation. Both of those classes lost over 50 lieutenants in Vietnam. That's 100 lieutenants that died. And what that then sort of, when I left, my platoon sergeant took over. The other platoon commander in our company, there was just two platoons there. Lieutenant Hausrath was killed a few weeks later. Most of the platoons in Hue City were run by NCOs. And all of them weren't staff sergeants either. Some of them were sergeants. Through the bulk of the fighting, the Marine Corps showed how the structure of our Marine Corps, that people can step up and do the job regardless of the situation.
I tell you, our thanks to Mark Bowden, author of Hue 68, The Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam, and to Richard Horner, and to our distinguished moderator, General Ray Smith. We also thank everyone here, as well as our in the audience, on radio, television, and the internet. We want to remind everybody that Mark's book is for sale back here, and he'll be pleased to sign copies following the program. So if you want to stay around, have a glass of wine, talk about the program, buy your book, and wait in line, do so. I'm Mike Myatt, and I call this meeting a joint meeting of the Commonwealth Club and the Marines Memorial Association as adjourned.